my name is Kieran Tavam, and welcome to the Football Spotlight, a podcast shining a light on those with intriguing stories from the women's game. On this episode, I speak with West Ham head coach Matt Beard, who joined the newly promoted Women's Super League club after an eventful spell in the NWSL with the Boston Breakers. We spoke about building yet another squad from scratch and his hopes for the new season, while Matt also gives some insight into his time in Boston. Like all these podcasts, I opened by asking Matt how he has dealt with being in the spotlight, especially over the last few months since joining the Hammers, and whether he has been comfortable being in the public eye. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my chat with Matt Beard.
Yeah, like you said, the women's game has definitely changed over the years. I mean, this is, I believe, my 13th year in women's football. Over the years, a lot of the women's game has been pushed via social media. Players and coaches in today's age now have a responsibility to, especially as role models, to aspiring coaches and young female girls that want to play. And being in the spotlight, you obviously have to maintain professionalism. But to be fair to the clubs that you work at, and of course the organisations and the bodies, you know, you get training and you get guidance on how to behave. But no, more than anything, I feel you have to be role models for these people that want to be in the position that you're in. You know, we're lucky with the job that we do. For me, having my family and especially two young children, you know, that changes anything in life, that your views on anything in life with your children and stuff. But you know, it's your job, and it's something that you're aware of and you adapt to, and it's just part of your everyday life. You know, you've got to take sometimes the rough with the smooth, especially if you're getting negative comments written about you. You've just got to take that as part and parcel of the job, you know. So I think the most important thing is that you remain professional and you remain dignified as well at the same time.
How different was it in the United States, where the game has had maybe longer to develop? It's arguably larger over there compared to what it is in England. When you went over to Boston, a lot of attention on you because you're an English coach going into the league. There were already British coaches in the league at certain clubs. How different was that?
Everything over there is driven through social media and obviously streaming, like YouTube initially. It's difficult. I mean, look, for me, going to America was to better myself as a coach, and I felt I learned a lot about myself. I learned a different style of football. I learned to deal with different characters, because, you know, I did feel I got a little bit stale in England towards the end at Liverpool. But you know, from a media point of view, it's I wouldn't say it's as big here, because you have, you know, look at England now, you've got Sky Sports, you've got BT Sport, you know, all covering whether it's Sky Sports News and BT Sport live games. You know, the BBC do a great job in promoting women's football. I think in America it's more, as I say, it's more, everything's more website, more YouTube. You know, the nightmare of that Go 90 thing, didn't they? So they're still trying to get it right out there with regards to that side. But one thing over there is it is very, very results driven. And, you know, if fans aren't happy, you'll definitely know about it. You'll get a few tweets and, you know, you'll hear about it. Whereas it's not really like that, I say, at the moment here. I haven't really seen it. So as it grows, as it gets bigger, and I'm sure that will all change, and at some point it may become a little bit like the men's game with the scrutiny and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think we're definitely starting to see that, aren't we? But one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, or the main reason I wanted to talk to you and bring you on this podcast, was obviously you've been in the spotlight over the last few months because you've taken on a really new and exciting project at West Ham United. Obviously, the club was successful in obtaining a WSL license, so they're going to be playing top division football this year for the first time. You have gone in a little bit like you did at Liverpool, to be fair, where you had a squad that needed overhauling, and that's not a criticism of the players that you had, but trying to build a team that was initially playing in the third tier of English football, trying to get a team ready for the first tier, as it will be this year. Give us some insight into how the early days are going, Matt. How's the building process going?
I've been really pleased. I mean, you know, I said to myself after Boston that I didn't really want a project like that again, because I'd done it. I had to do it at Boston. I'd done it at Liverpool, and it is, you know, it's tough. There's a lot of work that has to go into it. But when I'm at the club, and when you look at the facilities and you look at the ambition, ideally you get to see where they want to take it. It was something that really, really appealed to me, and I feel. Me and my family, we wanted to relocate back down south, and we didn't know what we was going to do. But this is an exciting project for me. We've built, I feel, a competitive team. We've got a great blend of experience, and we've got some youth. We've got pace in the team. And I've really, really enjoyed this pre-season working with this group of players, because in all my life working in women's football, you know, at Liverpool we had a great team spirit. The spirit here is it's different, it's unique, and I'm really intrigued to see how this team can develop over the course of the season. And I think the biggest thing for me with this project is, you know, it's not just a short term thing, it's a long term project where there's different phases to it. And I feel, you know, I think that's really, really important, that, you know, the players can see, look, this is phase one, this is what we're doing, this is phase two, and they can see that the club wants this team and this club to be successful in this division. Yes, it's going to take time. You know, I think the first four games, we've got three of the teams that finished in the top four last year. You know, these are teams that are established in Arsenal and Manchester City, and, you know, Kelly's done a fantastic job at Reading, and they've got stronger and better each season. So we've got a tough start, but it'd be a great marker to see where we are in comparison with the top four teams in the country. And like I say, I feel confident we can have a successful season. I think it's going to be one of the biggest stories in women's football, because this is probably the toughest job that I've ever taken on, because it is a brand new team. You know, whereas at Liverpool, you know, I think we recruited 13 players. We had a massive overhaul at Boston in my second year, you know. So it's something that I'm used to doing, and I know how to build teams and get us set up, and we'll see how we go. But we're really excited with what we can achieve here.
You mentioned right at the start of that answer, a lot of work to do. How do you go about prioritising what you need to do to try and get a team from pretty much scratch? And also, how difficult is it going into a club knowing that you're going to have to essentially let players down who, you know, aren't at the standard you need them to be, because they've been playing third-tier football? You're having to go in and essentially release them because you know that you need players of international quality and players that are going to be able to compete with the likes of Arsenal and Manchester City and Chelsea, like you said.
So just in answer to that end question, I mean, that was done before my appointment. So, you know, I come in with a clean slate to obviously recruit and bring players in. How I prioritise it, I think the first thing for me is really just to lay down the foundation and the fundamentals of sort of our DNA. So what I mean by that is, you know, a style of play that we like to play, or I like to play, you know, expectations of what I expect on a daily basis from the players, you know, from training to match day. And then we work with the players, you know, we work on, not only do we work on them as a team, but we work on them individually. We have short-term, medium-term, long-term plans for them players. You know, they have a big input to that. I mean, I have done it slightly differently to what I've done in the past. You know, I've got to know the player and the person. I've given myself time to do that. And, you know, one key thing that I want to say is that bringing in good people around me to help me, you know, staff to achieve, you know, what we need to achieve, I need good people around me. And, you know, I'm a big believer in having the right support staff, because I know my strengths and I know my weaknesses, and I need my staff to complement me in them areas. But I say, for me it's just really been about organisation, about first and foremost being, you know our shape, know sort of our patterns of play. And the other thing for me is the players know that they've got my full trust, and they have freedom, they can go and out express themselves, to work hard. And, you know, I think any successful team has to have a good work rate, and that's something that I've always demanded of my players. And as I say, this group have really, really taken to the ideas of how we want to play and what we want to do. They've had input into that as well. And I've been really, really lucky that we've got a really good group of players and we've got a really good group of people. And it's been fascinating watching them develop and grow as individuals and as friends and as teammates. It's going to be a really, really interesting journey.
How difficult was it to convince players to come on board of a project like that? Your homegrown players, Captain Gilly Flaherty, Claire Rafferty, Becky Spencer, they know you, they've played with you before, your time at Chelsea, and I know you know Gilly well, I know she's not played with you before, but the likes of a Bree Vasali, a Brooke Hendricks, an Alicia Lehmann, players that you've not worked with before, how do you go about convincing them to come to a club that, as I said, were playing third-tier football the year before, and really it's going into slightly the unknown, for want of a better term?
I think it's just about talking to them about them as a player, really. I think most importantly, you know, I watched a lot of games, I watched a lot of films, I watched a lot of clips of these players individually. I took the opportunity to speak with them and get to know them as people. And, you know, look, I've had the experience of doing this. This is like the third time I've done it now, of being able to come in to a job, assess it, make it better, and also develop players. You know, I've had a lot of players that have played for me over my career at Chelsea and at Liverpool that have gone from youth international to senior internationals. I've worked with some of the world's best players in England and in America. So, you know, I've got good experience. And I think one thing that, you know, that I can offer these players is the know-how on how to become winners and win things, you know. In my time, I've won three league titles, and you know, I've been quite fortunate that I've been in a position to do that. So it's really getting to know the player and making sure that they know that I'm going to invest in them and the club's going to invest in them. And as I say, from that perspective, when you come to West Ham, you see, you know, the training facilities that we have and the ambition of the football club and what the long-term plans are, you know, it that's quite an easy sell. What you have to really invest in is the person. And I think that's the one thing that I always try to do. I always try to get to know my players as people, because ultimately, you know the player. You know what you're trying to bring to the football club. And I think it's important that these people know that they can have a balance of football and their life. And you know, like I said before, you know, I put a lot of trust in my players. I let them have a big input into what we do, because ultimately they're the ones that cross the white line, and you've got to allow them to do their jobs.
You can coach the players on the field. You can get them ready for a game. But when you have so many new individuals, different characters, different nationalities, yep, how do you go about blending those personalities together? Because when you sign one or two players, you integrate them into a group that are all familiar with each other. You had to sign, what, a whole squad? We're talking maybe 15 players, 15 to 20 players that, yeah, don't know each other. Some of them will know each other. Gilly Flaherty, Becky Spencer, Claire Rafferty will play together at Chelsea. But there are a lot of those individuals that will not know each other. They haven't played and had much time on the field together. What does the club do to try and integrate a big group like that together?
Listen, I think we've all got a responsibility to obviously get to know each other. I mean, we've got some funny girls in this squad. It's you know, it's really interesting watching them. I mean, you know, one thing they've done which was intriguing to see, they drew names out of a hat and they had to buy like a coffee mug or a cup of tea mug for each other, and that mug had to describe that personality on who they drew out. And you know, they've done the grand opening, should I say. It was just great to see the camaraderie and the togetherness of the group. Listen, I think the most important thing that we do or as players and as a club is we just give them the platform to be able to come in and work every day. The rest of that stuff is really up to them. And you know, someone said to me today, look, we've recruited some really good people, and it's interesting seeing someone say that doesn't really know the group that well, and that's nice to hear. And I feel at the moment they're all getting on really, really well. And you know, as I said, we just provide them with a platform, and you know, we don't just work on the training pitch. We do classroom sessions. We'll talk about the things from expectations in training to what we can or what we can't control, and we'll discuss momentum and strategies and stuff like that. So we do a lot of work in that sense as well, to make sure the players understand. And again, a lot of that is driven from them, so they have that input. The way that I see it, it's a collective effort from the players themselves, and of course my staff and the club to make them things happen. And I'm really pleased with where we are as a group at the moment.
Like you said, signed a lot of individuals, a lot of good players, and I don't like picking individuals out, because I managed to watch the team in one of your pre-season friendlies, and there were a number of individuals that I could pick out. But the one that leaped out at me when you signed her was Julius Simic. Now, lots of experience in the Frauen Bundesliga. I'm really intrigued to know how you managed to pull that one off and how much of a big player you think she can be for you, because on her day, Julius Simic is as good as anyone.
Yeah, she's been amazing. I'm not just saying that. She's a great character. She really, really is. She's a funny girl. You know, her and Alicia Lehmann are probably the two biggest jokers of the team. No, she's excellent. She's, you know, watching her in training in tight areas, and, you know, her use of the ball is, you know, you said it, you know, on her day she could be one of the best. So, I have a good relationship with her agent, and she was at a point in her career where she was looking for something different. She was considering England, potentially America. I believe there was other offers from sort of Italy and Spain. So, you know, from us again, I think once people see what we're actually doing as a football club and they get to see it for themselves, you know, we brought Julia over with her boyfriend. We showed her around the facilities. We spoke about the plans. Obviously, I know Julia as a player because I've watched her play for many years. And, you know, we spoke to her about how important she's going to be for the team. I mean, one thing that I really like about Julia is the way that she can dictate the tempo of the game, and she's got great vision, she can see passes. And for me, with the way that we wanted to set this team up, that I needed someone like that in this team that could do that for me. And I was absolutely delighted that Julia decided to come, because, you know, she is an excellent player, but on top of that, she's a great, great character as well.
Can you tell me a bit about what influence or what involvement Jack Sullivan has? Obviously, for those that don't know, Jack Sullivan is the son of David Sullivan, the owner, or part, the co-owner of West Ham United. Jack has been vocal on social media over the last few months with the club getting its WSL license, but I know that he is overseeing, if you like, or certainly involved in the women's setup. I'm kind of interested to know what his involvement is.
Jack's one of the directors of the women's club. You know, during my time at the club, he's been nothing but supportive, and, you know, you've said on social media he's very, very supportive of the team, and I'm delighted that he's obviously so focused and wanting to make this team and club successful. So, you know, we're really lucky to have Jack on board.
I know you've said already it's going to take time. There are big established clubs in that division already. What does success look like for West Ham in that first season?
You know, for me, I'm not looking further than, you know, my first target is to get enough points to stay in the division. Once we tick that one off, then we can obviously progress. You've got the Continental Cup and the FA Cup, so there's obviously other competitions that we can be successful in. But I feel for me, you know, if we can be in and around the middle pack or knocking on the door of in and around sort of where Reading and Birmingham were last year, I think that would be, you know, a great success. You know, look, we are coming in this division to do as well as we can and finish as high as we can, and we'll be setting up to win every game. But, you know, we've got to be realistic. It's not 2013 when I took over at Liverpool, where the majority of the teams were part time, and, you know, it's a completely different story now. There's a lot more clubs with a lot more investment in, so, you know, I'm realistic enough to know that it's going to be, we're going to have highs, we're going to have lows, and I've got every faith in this group of players that we can be successful and have a good season.
Well, the opportunity at West Ham came about after a few years over in the NWSL in the United States with the Boston Breakers. Now, There will be people, I'm sure, listening to this who are Breakers fans or fans of the NWSL. And obviously on the 28th of January, which happens to be my birthday, so it was the worst present I could have received, the Breakers announced the Breakers announced that the team would be folding and ceasing operations, and they would not be participating in the league this year. You're obviously the head coach. I'm not sure how deep you can go or how honest you can be, but can you just sort of sum up or certainly go into how those last few weeks at the club were?
For me, when obviously we was informed, you know, the first thing I obviously thought about was my two children. Obviously, we were settled in the country and the kids were doing well in school. But then you also really feel for your players, because we was on a journey that I feel we was only halfway through. So it was frustrating not to see all the work that had gone in over there, especially the last season. You know, it's happened a few times in America. Kansas obviously went to Utah, and Western New York Flash went to North Carolina. So I think, you know, this was the second or third change, you know, in the NWSL history. So it was really tough to take, and you know, that's the nature of professional sports in America, and you know, you've just got to deal with it and get on with it.
There were a lot of rumours floating around before it happened, and I know you and I spoke a couple of times during that period, and you were pretty honest with me and said, look, Kieran, we don't really know what's happening. There's not much information coming our way. As much as the club folding, was that also incredibly frustrating? Because you've probably, I'm going to assume, got players, you know, knocking on your door saying, Matt, what's happening? There's all these rumours the club's folding, and you don't have answers for them.
Well, I think one thing that did come out of that process was the way that it was handled by the NWSL. You know, not only did the players not have information, neither did, you know, the coaching staff, or even, as far as I'm aware, our ownership group. So hopefully, in the future, that people can learn from the mistakes of what happened, especially with the way that it was dealt with. You know, there's times where you couldn't even get hold of the league for sometimes up to a week. So that was obviously frustrating for so many people, you know, not just like me, because I was on a visa. You know, there's also, you've got just your office, front office staff, as an example, that some of them had visas, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff that put a lot of stress on a lot of people. And, you know, hopefully there will be lessons learned from that. And obviously it wasn't a nice process to be part of, but, you know, like I said before, it was one of them situations that, you know, as staff at a football club or a soccer club, as it's called in America, we was aware from November that the current ownership group were looking to sell it. You know, I think in this ownership group, they was looking just to pass it on, basically, to another owner. And, you know, I think it was a night before the draft that the person or the company that was due to buy it pulled out. And obviously it was tough to take, because we was in Philadelphia ready for the draft, you know. So it was a tough process. You know, it took a long time for our supporters to get their money back from their season tickets as well. So hopefully, as I say, there'll be lessons learned from the way that it was handled. But I mean, any situation like that, it's tough for everyone, and it's tough for the NWSL. But ultimately, everyone has dealt with that and moved on. And, you know, it's going to be another, as I say, learning experience for everyone. And it is what it is, and you can't change it.
How difficult was it to, I know it was during the off-season, wasn't it? But how difficult was it trying to prepare for that draft, trying to prepare for a new season, not really knowing what the future of the team was going to be?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, we was preparing as normal, and, you know, as I said, it was the night before the draft that the group that were trying to buy it pulled out. So, you know, as far as we was concerned, it was going to go through. Obviously, it all changed the night before the draft, and you know, we had a meeting with the NWSL, and everyone saw Amanda Duffy's comments that was made at the draft, that they were committed to 10 teams. But unfortunately, I just think maybe due to the timing of it all, maybe it was too little too late for, you know, the owners of the league and the owners of the clubs and US Soccer to save the club. I don't know. I mean, that's something that would have to be answered by, you know, that group. But we was under clear instructions that they were committed and they would try to run 10 teams. You know, there was always a threat that it could fold. And unfortunately, you know, as I say, the ownership group made that decision to not run Boston, or for Boston to go. And obviously it was tough to take. But as I say, it's happened, and you have to move on. I was just desperately disappointed for the fans, really, because it was a good fan base, a loyal fan base, you know. And they've been through the mill, bless them, you know, from having a successful team in 2013 and then to the team struggling for many years, and they could see the work that was going on and we was turning the corner, and you know, they didn't get to see that, unfortunately. So I was desperately disappointed for them, and I really do hope that, you know, that Boston can get a franchise again. So, you know, they've got a good fan base ready and waiting for a new franchise in Boston.
Yeah, hear, hear, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I had a chance to speak to Bree Vasali, your new midfielder at West Ham, after one of your pre-season games. And obviously she was drafted this year by Chicago, never actually earned a contract, was on the practice squad. The fact the league is now 9 teams with Boston being removed from the competition now means that there is one less team for college players to come into. There is those players from Boston had to be essentially distributed between the other 9 teams. How difficult do you think it is going to be, unless there's expansion, for young players to get into that league now? Because you've got players like Bree, picked 19th overall. Now, in previous years, 19th would probably have got her a starting place, or certainly a place on the bench. It would have earned her a contract. And the fact is that she had to seek opportunities elsewhere because she couldn't even get in the 20-player roster.
Yeah, so we're obviously lucky for that, because Bree's a very talented player. It's a funny one. I think the college draft, how do I explain it? You know, these girls get called up and very rarely do they win a contract. You know, they've got like 13, 15 days. And one thing that I didn't like about the draft system, the Price is Right, you know, where they come down and they get called down. That's the only way I can describe it. And, you know, a lot of these girls get let down and end up finishing. I think that's a big thing in America, that once you finish college, you've only got the NWSL. Beyond that, there's nothing. So where do these girls go? Where do they play? And it's a frustrating thing for me. Bree Vasali is a great player. The college draft and only having 9 teams, I mean, I don't even know how many got signed. McCaskill was one. I'm trying to think who else. Quinn, two. You know, there's not many that I can remember from this draft class that actually won contracts with, you know, with the clubs. And it's going to get tougher and tougher. You know, they need more teams to facilitate all these talented players that are coming out of college.
You mentioned earlier that you went to America to become a better coach, or certainly to develop as a coach. What did you learn from your time out there? What was the biggest learning curve for you?
Obviously, the first season was tough because we really struggled. I think there's two words of advice I would give any coach that goes overseas. You know, I went to an English-speaking country, but what I never did in my first year, and I really, really regret it, was not learning their language. And what I mean by that is, they're, obviously they call it soccer. And I used to get a lot of stick from people back home when I used to call it soccer when I was out there. And what I'm trying to say is the way they describe things are different, you know. If you listen to them, you'll know, because you watch the NWSL games, like Upper 90 and, you know, One Time and all them little things like that. I regretted not doing that first year. I was a little bit ignorant to it at the start. You know, I still called them football books. I still called the bibs, or the pinnies, bibs as an example, and all them little terminologies. And that's one thing that I regretted not doing. So wherever you go, if any coach is listening to this and they go overseas, if it's a non-English speaking country, learn the language. If it's an English speaking country, learn the football language. And that's one thing that I could say. Obviously, the first year we struggled results wise. So you get to learn a lot about yourself. You doubt yourself, and you've got to get through them little periods. And I feel that I come off the back of that stronger. But one thing that really tripped me up as well in America was, I feel the football education for the players in America isn't as good as probably the majority of the world. And what I mean by that is, they don't get taught how to play the game. They get taught to be athletes, and they get taught how to win. And you can probably see with the national team as an example, you've got a lot of athletic, very skillful winners in the American women's national team. And that's what they're built up on. Now, because Boston didn't have a lot of value in their roster, we had to invest in youth. Now, I don't feel their college game out there isn't regulated, by the way. You have to have a certain coaching badge. You could not have a coaching badge and work in the college. And it's all about winning. Nothing else, it's about winning. And I just feel in my first year, I didn't understand the lack of football knowledge that these players had. So I'm trying to ask them to do things that they're not necessarily, that they can do. You know, as an example, a fullback didn't know where to be when the ball was on the opposite side of the pitch, and just little things like that. If you watch the highlights in the NWSL, a lot of goals are transitional, counter-attacks, because a lot of teams are really, really out of balance. So I had to adjust my style of play to the players that I had. We recruited a team to try and play in a certain way the second year, but unfortunately we had one or two sort of injuries, like Rose Lavelle, for example. You know, you lose a player of that quality, it hurts you. But I learnt a new way. Paul Riley has got it spot on. He's got a lot of athletic players that are quick, that are strong, that can get about the pitch, that can unsettle you, dangerous on set plays. And Paul Riley is probably one of the best coaches I've had the opportunity to speak to interact with, share ideas with in the world, without a shadow of a doubt. And you know, it's really, really interesting. I'm not saying I want to bring a little bit of America to England, but especially the press and the way that teams play over there, I would like to try and bring a little bit of the athleticism and stuff like that to the FAWSL and see how that works and put some of that into practice. And I think that's why this pre-season for me has been so interesting, because I'm doing things differently to what I would have done before in England. And I feel they're the biggest things that I've learned, is a different style of football. You're coaching different players with different mentalities. It reminded me a little bit of having to work back in academies, you know, where you do, you know, my week in England generally is when I was at Liverpool with the players that I worked with. You come in, you do like a little day for the players, you do 2 day preparation for the game, and then you play. Whereas in America, it was individual programs, it was doing functions, phases, 11v11. So you're having to go through the whole process sort of from start to finish on, this is what we want to get out of this week, or this is our game plan for this week, this is what we need to do. And we have to break it down into them little sections. So the work we had to put in was a lot of work. And for me as a coach, it helped me put more detail into my work. Obviously, when you're new going into a different country, you've got to learn about the teams, you've got to learn about the coaches, you've got to learn about the individual players. Whereas in England, I was comfortable with that. I knew all the players, I knew all the coaches, I know how Man City were going to play, I know how, you know, Birmingham were going to play under Marcus and David Parker. So it made me appreciate a little bit more the work that you've got to put in to make sure that your teams are successful, they're organised, and you give them the best opportunity to win games.
In every one of these podcasts, I have been asking guests to pick a game to bring under the spotlight, a game that was significant in their career. It could be a win, it could be a game that they lost but they learned a lot from. You've managed in a lot of games, Matt, both in the UK and in the US, but the game that you picked, and I don't think there's any surprise, was your win over Bristol Academy in 2014. That was on the final day of the Women's Super League season. There were three teams that could have won the title. There was yourselves at Liverpool, Chelsea and Birmingham. And you were going into that final weekend in third place. You were without question the outsiders, but results went your way and you ended up winning back-to-back titles. It sounds a dumb question, having just given that intro, but why have you picked that game out of all of them that you could have?
You hit the nail on the head. I remember someone saying we was 8-1 to win the league that day. No, you know what? I'll never forget the night before that game. You know, me and my wife, we went out for a meal. We had a couple of glasses of wine. I was pretty relaxed. I felt we would get Champions League qualification. I was confident in that. But I didn't expect Chelsea to slip up at Manchester City. But we prepared the girls as we did. And I remember being in my office and I saw Manchester City's team sheet, because I think they was in the Conti Cup final on the Thursday. And I was really disappointed because they put out a weakened team. And especially with what was at stake, you know, that was quite frustrating. But anyway, fair play to Man City, because they obviously produced. And I'll never forget, we said we didn't want to try and hear, obviously, the results. We didn't want to know. We just wanted to concentrate on the 90 minutes and do what we could to try and win the game. But of course, within, I think, 20 minutes, Chelsea were 2-0 down, I believe. And we've got, obviously, the fans behind us, you know, singing. And then we knew Birmingham were losing. So at half-time, we made some tactical adjustments. We changed the system. And, you know, we went out and completely dominated the second half and won 3-0. And I just think that period of waiting for them results to finish, because we finished before both the Man City game and the Notts County Birmingham game. It felt like an eternity on that pitch. And I remember Angela Roberts, my general manager, come running out. And I had family in the box at Widnes at the top, and they was all jumping up and down. And obviously we knew that both games were over and we'd won the league. And it was just, it was an amazing feeling. And it was, as I say, it was like an eternity waiting. And I just felt the circumstances throughout that day, you know, Chelsea were obviously expected to win it. And, you know, I felt I've always felt confident because Rick Passmore's teams were always tough to play against. So I felt Notts County would get a result against Birmingham that day, and I felt that the occasion would be too big for Birmingham. And, you know, I wasn't expecting Chelsea to obviously lose the game. And it was an amazing day. It was an amazing feeling. And, you know, especially with the injuries that we had that year, you know, we lost Nicole Rolzo, and throughout that year we had to make slight adjustments to the way that we generally play. I come back to, obviously, you have to work with the players that you've got and that are available. So it was just an amazing day, and to win back-to-back titles was a great achievement for that group of players. You know, it's something they thoroughly deserved. And I think, if I remember rightly, you know, we'd only lost two games that year, if I can remember rightly. But obviously, to do the back-to-back thing, it was a real nice feeling.
Because only Arsenal have managed that in the FAWSL, haven't they? It's in the 7 years the league has been going. Liverpool won it back-to-back in 2013, 2014. Arsenal did it in 11 and 12. Yeah. Man City and Chelsea have kind of hopped between seasons since then. But that must give you a lot of pride, because we see now that despite the fact there are some strong teams that dominate, it's not easy to do back-to-back titles, is it?
No, I mean, it's very rare that it happens. I mean, if you look in the men's Premier League, generally you win the title. I mean, I think, what was it, Chelsea finished 7th or 8th the year after, as an example. It's tough to do. As I say, I was lucky that the players that we worked with, when you've got players like Farrell Williams, Lucy Bronze, you know, we had Gemma Davison that year, Gemma Bonner, you know, we had a fantastic group of players. You know, we had Natasha Dowie that scored goals. And but again, most importantly, there was a good group of people, and I can't stress the importance of that. You know, I've watched teams sign some top players, and for whatever reason, they don't gel or they don't have that togetherness. And especially in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, in female sport, I genuinely believe that the female athlete in team environment are socially driven, and I think it's important that that you give them the right platform to be able to socially to interact and get on, and that's something that I always try to do with my teams in the female game. And it was an amazing achievement. It was probably my biggest achievement. I mean, knocking Arsenal off their perch in the first year was good, but I think we really deserved it that year. And I knew, you know, I think when we beat Chelsea 4-3, I knew we'd go on and win the league. You know, I think Becky Easton scored an own goal in the 82nd minute. We brought Kate Longhurst off the bench, and then we won and win 1-4-3. So from that moment, I knew we would go and win the league. Whereas that year, it was a little bit more unexpected. And, you know, we tested the players mentally, because we had to change systems, you know, from a 4-3-3 to a 3-5-2. And we did numerous things that year to get results. It wasn't pretty at times, but it was effective. But it was an amazing achievement, and one that I can look back with personal pride, you know, with the team. And, you know, Heather, who LFC Ladies fans, you know, every now and then she'll share, you know, like a memory on Twitter or Facebook, and it's always great watching them and looking back at them moments and memories, and they'll live with me forever.
Well, that was the past, a fantastic achievement, no doubt, and I'm sure that you're looking in the future to try and achieve similar with West Ham United. I really appreciate your time, Matt, the insight, the talking about West Ham, Boston, and of course that amazing day, as you described it, for Liverpool in 2014. Thanks for giving me your time, and good luck for the new season.
Thank you.
So many thanks there to Matt for some insight into his early days with West Ham, and the sad end, of course, to his time in Boston. I wish him well for his first season back in England in the FAWSL. Don't forget to check out some of our other podcasts on iTunes, Spotify and Google Podcasts, where you can hear from the likes of Dagny Brynjarsdottir, Ali Wagner, Heather O'Reilly, and this from Jackie Gronin.
It was so special to me because I think I never thought I would have it, because I had a long time where I wasn't in the national team at all. I stopped when I was playing in the under-17s, and kind of closed that whole chapter in a way.
Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for giving this podcast your time. Do please tell people about us on social media and spread the word. You can find us on Twitter on @FootySpotlight. But for now, on this episode, it's time to dim the spotlight and say goodbye.